know what's been covered. My name's Paul Muth. This is News from Neptune. Old and storied name, indeed. Jeff Cohen and Martin Lee are one of the some of the founders of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting that makes Counterspin. And I've got Jeff Cohen from last weekend, actually, in the aftermath of the No Kings. Going to play part of that again because I haven't seen the kind of analysis that he's done. I have a bit of that also from John Nichols, Madison, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C. I think he splits his time. Talking about that and the defense budget at some length, and I think it's worth it. Talking about a reconciliation bill that was going to add that $200 billion, actually more than they're asking for more than that in the reconciliation, totals to $1.5 trillion that the ask for, and a cut overall perhaps of 10% more, of 10% on the so-called discretionary spending. I don't know. Perhaps even cutting into the non-discretionary spending. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. I wanted to mention that John Nichols is a longtime collaborator with the late, great Bob McChesney on a number of books. And I'm sure he would be happy to hear that Local News Day has been declared April 9th. That's the first I heard of it. I guess it's an inaugural concept to have a focus on local news. It's a bit of a sad story in a lot of regards. So I have an older piece from Amy Goodman that wasn't broadcast, a web exclusive. I actually missed the first part, an Iranian guy. Won't be playing all of it because it covers the negotiation process. And though nothing's changed, and it probably would stand as analysis, it's been superseded a bit, I guess. And I want to play some other material, so I'll be excerpting some stuff on the fly as well. And where did that come from? No recent Mumia Abu-Jamal commentary. There's a lot of commentary coming up from other inmates. It's a way of looking at the inside. Self-selected, of course, people that have the gumption to, actually make a commentary that goes out in public that might have repercussions on the way they're treated by their guards. I don't know. There's a new web exclusive. Maybe I'll get to that tomorrow. It's a follow-up of the interview of the Palestinian woman who was in an ICE detention for about a year and just been released, and it's just a horrible thing. Oh, yeah, Code Pink from Flashpoints, not with Dennis Bernstein, with his fill-in host who's a scholar and activist on Haiti issues, Kevin Pena. I think he says it with a augmented N. I don't know how to describe that, actually. So Code Pink, Pink Notes, it's now a new feature on Flashpoints, and Kevin Pena does the honors. Plays Pete Hegseth's prayers. Did you notice that Hegseth had a Good Friday event at the ceremony, I guess, at the Pentagon, and he barred Catholics? I guess he's think the Pope's too woke, which is okay with me. All right, that's kind of the rundown. Ran into Gus Wood, and he'll be in. They were busy off both doing something last week, but they're both going to be in here, so I'm anxious to hear how they're going to wrap up the last couple of weeks of our torrent of facts and news and blather from Trump. The Strait of Trump, he joked at a Saudi investment. He's going to rename stuff. He still wants a 51st state, whether it's Greenland or Canada or whomever. I don't think it'll be Puerto Rico, but he really wants a star on the flag that's he can point at, I guess, his legacy. Let's start with part of the Amy Goodman interview, Ali. Well, I'll let her say his name, as I'll probably not do a good job of it. Behruz Ghamari Tabrizi, who has had a couple of interviews with Democracy Now!, I've gotten to say his name well. He used to be here on campus and came back to give a talk on his new book, The Long War on Iran. Quite an interesting different view than you hear. All right, I guess I'll leave it at that and turn it over to Amy. And again, I'm going to excerpt this web exclusive segment. Okay, before I do that, there's some business. I needed to thank people for hitting the $10,000 match. It's actually a pretty modest goal. Doubled, though, for $20,000, but if you haven't been put it off, you can still donate. It won't be matched to $10,000 because we've already hit that point, but anything you can contribute would be great. Appreciate all of the response. Thanks to that major anonymous donor. And here's an underwriting announcement from the business next door, Australian proprietor.
By Live Action Games. If you're looking for a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles, Live Action Games has you covered. Live Action Games is open Tuesday through Saturday at 111 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, right next door to WEFT. New and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items or additional Live Action Games information, please visit lag217.com or call 217-359-4863. That's 217-359-GAME.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S.-Israeli war in Iran has entered its fifth week. President Trump told the Financial Times Sunday his preference would be to, quote, take the oil and seize Iran's export hub, Harg Island. Shortly after his comments, the price of oil surged to $116 a barrel. Separately, President Trump spoke to reporters aboard Air Force One and boasted about regime change in Iran.
Regime change, you look already, because the one regime was decimated, destroyed, they're all dead. The next regime is mostly dead. And the third regime, we're dealing with different people than anybody's dealt with before. It's a whole different group of people.
Trump's comments come as 3,500 U.S. troops began arriving in the region on Friday. The Washington Post reported Saturday night that the Pentagon was preparing for weeks of potential ground conflict in Iran. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting President Trump is considering a military operation to extract nearly 1,000 pounds of uranium from Iran. According to a consortium of human rights groups in Iran, nearly 1,500 Iranian civilians, at least 217 children, have been killed in U.S. and Israeli strikes. CENTCOM says more than 300 U.S. troops have been wounded. 13 U.S. service members have died. For more, we're joined by Ali Khadivar, fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard University, associate professor of sociology and international studies at Boston College. He grew up in Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, was active in the student movement at the University of Tehran. He joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Khadivar, you have brothers still in Iran. Can you talk about whether you can reach them, whether the internet is still down, and what is happening on the ground in Iran right now?
Yes, I have brothers in Tehran and elsewhere in Iran. We cannot directly reach them. The Iranian government has shut down internet and restricted phone communication. People in Iran can call outside, And if they can buy very expensive VPNs and filters, then they can momentarily connect to internet. So the communication with Iran for most people has been one way. It's people in Iran that communicate.
I mean,
people are, from what I hear, yeah.
No, go ahead.
I think there are a different group of people. Many people are scared of the war. They are waiting for the war to end. On the other hand, government has been mobilizing its supporters very actively. Iranian government has been one of the type of political regimes that have relied on mobilizing their supporters in various occasions under external pressure. The level of mobilization has been higher, for example, under sanctions, and under wartime condition has been highest, both during the Iran-Iraq war and under the current war, especially that it started with killing of Khamenei, and he has many supporters. So government supporters have been in main squares. They have been marching in streets, chanting slogans. So public spaces have been very much just in control of government and their people.
This must bring back memories. As you sit here in the United States, you're looking at the bombs over Tehran and other cities. You grew up under bombs. In that case, it was the Iran-Iraq war, right, with the U.S. Supporting both sides, I guess you could say. Explain the history for people who aren't familiar with the history of Iran.
So, looking at Iran's modern history, we have had a few different issues, major issues of Iranian politics that have been interwoven. So for the topic of our conversation, one recurring issue is imperial wars and intervention over Iran. So starting in early 19th century, we have the wars of Iran and Russia, that Iran lost territory. Then with Britain, when Afghanistan became independent, Iran was neutral in World War I and II. It was occupied in both times. Head of state was removed in 1941, Reza Shah. But then we had the 1953 coup sponsored by United States and UK. And then, as you mentioned, Iran-Iraq war, which was a regional war. But both sides received support. I think Iraq received more intelligence and support. And these wars have shaped Iranian political development. From early on, one question for Iranians was that, why are we over and over become the subject of military aggressions by great powers, by imperial powers, and they have been looking for solutions for that. On the other hand, we have had these ongoing issues about defining political order in Iran. We have had the constitutional revolution. We have had the ongoing democracy movement in Iran, various social movements and protests in which Iranians have demanded opening political freedom and democracy. When we look at how these wars have impacted the political order, going back to Iran-Iraq war again, as your question mentioned, in general, the wars have not been conducive to democratic breakthroughs. Quite the opposite. They have resulted in more militarized authoritarianism, more closed political space in Iran. When Iran-Iraq war started, when Iraq invaded Iran, we still have nationalist president Abu'l-Hassan Bani Saad. They were nationalists and other opponents of Islamists. Within the parliament, Iranian civil society and political society was highly mobilized. But the war presented an opportunity for Islamists to basically consolidate power. They oppose all of their opponents to be working or being on the side of the enemies. They escalated repression and violence against their opponents. And within 1 or 2 years within Iran-Iraq war, we see that the political scene completely changes as a result of government repression. They basically pushed out and sidelined all rival factions. They demobilized Iranian civil society with using different forms of repression. And currently, we are observing the same situation in Iran. We have the internet shutdown, which basically disconnects Iranian citizens from each other. Iranian public sphere, which was operating on internet, for now, that just doesn't exist anymore. So the government has continued to execute political prisoners. They're still arresting activists and journalists. So the current condition is very repressive, and with the killings of the different individuals in the leadership, more hardline and more hawkish individuals have been replaced. So we are seeing again what war is doing to Iran's political order. And as President Trump mentioned, this is not the type of regime change we initially talk about in the U.S., but there has been political change within the Islamic Republic. Islamic Republic has changed to various direction in its 47 years life. Sometimes it has opened up, sometimes it has become more repressive and more close. And this is the latter, when the political situation has become darker, more repressive, and the government has become more hawkish and hardline.
Okay. I think this is when they went into talking about whether there is really something beyond Kabuki theater negotiations or not. Part of why I played that was because it mentioned Bonnie Sandra and the diversity in the revolution at the very beginning. There's a book out called Devil's Game. I had it out of the library. I didn't really finish it. But the thesis is that the U.S. always prefers reactionary, fundamentalist, religious, political alignments to secular nationalists like Bonnie Sadra recommended, represented. And the war, as he pointed out, allowed the clerics to consolidate power, repressive means, etc., also with some aid from the U.S., aiding both sides, the Iran-Contra deal that was cut that sent arms to Iran, helped consolidate the elite's power to the detriment of the democratic impulse, I think. And that's an untold story. It's also untold that Jeffrey Epstein had something to do with facilitating the Iran-Contra deal. It still hasn't come out. When it will, other than in drop site news. Anyway, opinions are those of the speakers I mentioned. We're going to hear some Code Pink. Why don't we go to that right now? And we'll get back to John Nichols and some view from D.C. And like I say, a pretty long discussion of the so-called defense budget. I guess they call it the War Department. It's noticeable that Department of War is Dow, like Dow Jones and Dow Chemicals, so you don't know what you're talking about. Some kind of armament system, one of them deploys it and the other makes money off of it. So, yeah, just another word game.
Your daily investigative news magazine, Flashpoints. Well, let's go ahead and open this program with a well-known bite that's circulating of the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, giving a now infamous prayer before the assembled at the Pentagon. Listen in.
Let every round find its mark against the enemies of righteousness and our great nation. Give them wisdom in every decision, endurance for the trial ahead, unbreakable unity, and overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. Preserve their lives, sharpen their resolve, and let justice be executed swiftly and without remorse, that evil may be driven back and wicked souls delivered to the eternal damnation prepared for them. For the wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. We ask these things with bold confidence in the mighty and powerful name of Jesus Christ, King over all kings, and amen.
And that was the voice of Secretary of War, or, you know, the press these days won't even acknowledge the change of the name. They still continue to call it the Secretary of Defense, the Department of Defense. And now joining me is Cynthia Papermeister. She's with Code Pink. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Well, we just heard Pete Hegseth go on his rant about, you know, Jesus being on the side of the United States and how this is a new holy war. What's your view on that, and what is Code Pink doing in response to this? Oh, I don't know. This isn't even the confluence of church and state anymore. This is something else altogether.
You know, this is one of the scariest moments that I can remember. Our Secretary of War believes that he and Trump has his finger on the nuclear weapons button, are anointed by God to bring about the apocalypse. I'm just going to say that one more time. They feel that they are anointed by God to bring about the apocalypse or the end times. And Hegseth holding prayer meetings at the Department of Defense or War, I mean, it's alarming. 200 military members have filed complaints about Hegseth's violations of religious regulations. So his religious crusade in which key deciders are motivated by extremist religious agendas, not just imperialism, oil, and AIPAC, is just scaring the bejesus out of us. So no wonder they don't care about killing civilians or the war spreading. So we're just forming a campaign. We're getting it underway to get him out. He's got to be gotten out. Now, there is some good news. 30 members of Congress have sent a letter to the Department of Defense asking for an investigation of what he's doing over there, holding these prayer meetings. And, let's see, one of the lawmakers said, "These outrageous statements justifying a war based on interpretations of biblical prophecies and informing troops that they are risking their lives to advance a specific religious vision raises not only glaring constitutional concerns, but potential violations of Department of Defense regulations regarding religious neutrality."
No kidding.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, it's like sounding the alarm with Code Pink and everyone else. He cannot stay at the Department of War, the Department of Defense. He cannot. This is really, really scary.
Well, this goes, I believe, to this question of Armageddon and what many evangelicals call the literal interpretation of the Book of Revelations, right? Gog and Magog and all of this language that basically says that, you know, this all leads to the second coming of Christ, and that somehow Trump is now the trigger that God has used to bring about the end of the world. And you're right. It's absolutely insane. And thank God. There you go. Thank goodness. Thank whatever deity you praise that Code Pink is waging this campaign to get rid of this maniac. I mean, even just the, you know, Department of Defense, Department of War, maybe it was a little more honest, because honestly, it's always been sort of the Department of War. But I mean, just the fact that he's now put himself in the mantle. I mean, you've probably heard these speeches, right, that he's given about Iran, right? We negotiate through bombs. We negotiate through bombing, right? We don't talk. Our diplomacy is dropping more bombs on the enemy. This is unheard of.
On the enemy, as Trump has said, he wants to bring him back to the Stone Age. That is a war crime. Absolutely. So Hegseth, Trump, these are war crimes that they
bridges,
are advocating.
Schools, exactly, hospitals, they are war crimes. And I think that maybe at least given the level of technology and recording that we have going on around the world, that at least now a good portion of it's in the public record, right? It's not going to go away. And I think what Code Pink does is really important, because what you guys do is you guys actually act in many ways as the institutional memory of these sorts of horrendous crimes that are done by the U.S. government, and particularly what's going on under the Trump administration today.
Yeah. We're trying. We just keep trying. We've been at it for over 20 years, and we have to keep going. A friend was just here. She's been crying a lot because she's been to Iran. You know, it's a beautiful country full of beautiful people. They don't deserve what we're doing to them. And we don't deserve to be paying for that. You know, we're having a hard time paying taxes for this kind of thing. It's $1 billion a day that we are spending on this illegal war of choice.
And again, that's the voice of Cynthia Papermeister. She is with Code Pink. Well, Cynthia, let's talk a little bit more. I always don't want to assume that somebody hasn't just tuned in who doesn't know who Code Pink is, or anyone that I'm interviewing. Let's talk a little bit about who Code Pink is, what Code Pink is, and the work that you guys are doing.
Okay, thank you. We are a feminist grassroots organization of not just women. We originally called ourselves Code Pink Women for Peace. We have every gender identity involved. And we are an activist group. We confront, expose, disrupt the war machine wherever we see it. We're famous for our sort of gutsy confrontations, especially in Congress. You'll see one of our co-founders, Medea Benjamin, and colleagues in Congress a lot, disrupting hearings and trying to interview senators and representatives as they're scurrying around the Capitol with hard-hitting questions. Why are you supporting this genocide? Why are you voting my tax dollars for 2,000-pound bombs for Israel? Those kinds of questions. And they don't like it. Most of them, they don't like to be confronted. And that's fine. This is this is our job as Code Pink. Just to expose their hypocrisy, their cruelty, their lack of compassion for other people. And these are the sort of monsters who are running our government. So just to be honest with you, we have to keep going. We have to keep going and doing this work. And we do it with joy. We do it with love. Code Pink wears pink. You see us out there, and we're easily identified because, you know, we like to wear pink. One of our co-founders, Jody Evans, likes to say five women wearing pink is very, very noticeable. But we are not a threat to anybody. We're a totally nonviolent organization. Now, I do want to say one thing, though, that is really bothering me. The right-wing media and some of the politicians are saying that Code Pink is somehow agents of the Russians and the Chinese. They don't like dissidents, and they never have. They, meaning the war machine and the government. We are dissidents, and we're proud of it. We are patriots. We want this country to follow the law, follow the Constitution, follow the law, which is being broken all the time.
International law.
And not just by Trump, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, and members of Congress who are funding weapons for Israel. That is illegal. That is illegal under many U.S. and international laws. So to get our government to follow the law and to put human needs before the war machine's greed, that's our work.
Sounds good to me.
We're working at it all the time. We don't stop.
And again, that's the voice of Cynthia Papermeister. We are talking about Code Pink. And you know, I've also heard, you know, you're paid protesters, right? You guys are paid, you know, and I know a lot of folks in Code Pink, and they're not exactly well-to-do or well-heeled. You know, folks are contributing their time.
Get any payment from anybody. That is such.
Well, it went from you're a communist to now you're a paid protester. These people are shameless.
Indeed, they are. What annoys me is people talking about Medea Benjamin being performative and basically just, you know, enjoying disrupting cabinet meetings, or not cabinet, well, hearings on the Hill and stuff. But she's been prolific in writing books, too, on the House of Saud, trying to sort out the Ukrainian situation, number of other books in the process. So, and a longtime activist with Global Exchange. Has still around, and one of their projects right now is sending solar panels to Cuba. All right, well, that's an excerpt. That's a regular feature called Pink Notes, and not your regular host, Dennis Bernstein with Flashpoints. It's Kevin Pena, as I mentioned, filmmaker and activist scholar on Haiti mainly, lived down there during some of the coups that the U.S. engineered, at least two of them, I think, since they came thick and fast and previous decade. Let's see, John Nichols talking about the budget. And we'll get to a little bit of Jeff Cohen, since I did pitch him and talked about him being involved in the counterspin program through the origination of fairness and accuracy in reporting. About halfway through, so maybe I'll reprise opinions or those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Thanks a lot to everybody who made it possible to match the $10,000 matching grant. Nominally, the pledge, the donation drive is over yesterday, but if you didn't do it, you still can. We won't have the matching money, but we'll have yours. Appreciate any effort you can make on behalf of community media now more than ever. And let's see. Yeah, here's Brian Edwards Tiekert again from Pacifica. Local news to the country, I guess. I don't know. I'm riffing. This was recorded just yesterday, so it's pretty fresh. And like I say, the so-called defense budget, the war budget, since it's the War Department, this big ask, that's going to do a lot of damage if it goes ahead. They're planning on getting some of it, the Iran war money, through reconciliation. What a bizarre name for a Senate ploy. So there's no veto. Cloture vote.
This morning. The big one is that the president has fired the head of the Department of Justice. Only the second person he's pushed out of his cabinet, which stands in stark contrast to his first run of the presidency. Pam Bondi spent 423 days on the job. She presided over the purges of some 5,000 career Justice Department employees, seeming to especially target anyone who'd been involved with investigating Donald Trump or the January 6th insurrection. She also hollowed out divisions ranging from civil rights to counterterror, and her deprofessionalized Justice Department posted some spectacular failures trying to press politically motivated criminal charges against people the administration decided were its enemies. Unclear what was the final straw, but it feels like we're learning something about how power works in this administration. So we've invited back John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
It's good to talk to you, John. We've got Kristi Noem and now Pam Bondi. What is the theme aside from it's not great to be a woman working for Trump?
Well, that's an interesting thing to note, isn't it, right up front, that the two people that he has held to account are both women, and both women who were, by most measures, incredibly loyal to him. I mean, tried to do everything that he told them to do, and even at the expense of their own reputations. And so it's clear that the president is upset with where he's at politically. His poll numbers are terrible. They are no longer just bad for, baseline approval. They're bad on the issues that were once effective for him, economic issues as well as immigration and a host of other matters. And so he's looking for people to remove. Whether he's doing this to suggest that there is, a change of course, or at least some desire to do a better job, or whether he is simply doing it out of frustration, that's a tougher thing to measure. But the reality is you've seen two major figures in the administration removed in relatively rapid succession. Noem not very long ago, now Pam Bondi. And there is talk that there are other people within the administration with whom he is frustrated. And that talk, a lot of that focuses on Kash Patel at the FBI. There is also this question of whether there will come a point where Pete Hegseth over at the Department of Now War is in a good position. Hegseth is firing a lot of people himself, generals and others, clearly trying to suggest that the problems with the war with Iran are not his fault, but that of his subordinates. But at some point,
or clearing obstacles to escalating it. I mean, he fired like three high-ranking generals in the army in the last 24 hours. Some of the speculation on social media is these would be the voices inside the military saying, no, it's a really bad idea to send in ground troops.
I agree with you. And I think that's all a part of this mix. And in fact, in reality, it may be as significant or more significant that the three generals were removed than Bondi. Because when we are in a state of war, and especially a war that is so chaotic and so seemingly thought as this one, the removal of those generals at this point is unsettling in the least. And whether it is, Hegseth saying people are getting in his way of doing what he wants to do, or whatever other signal is being sent, that is worthy of, I would argue, a significant amount of attention, because it may tell us something about where the president and the Secretary of War want to go.
This seems like quite a contrast to the first one. I keep coming around to this. He put people in at the Department of Justice who, when pressed, showed a modicum of independence.
Yes.
And fealty to the idea that the Department of Justice should operate with some independence from the presidency. Bondi was nothing if not loyal. She didn't do what Kristi Noem did, which was implicate Donald Trump in one of her own scandals. Noem was fired right after at a congressional hearing. She said Donald Trump had signed off on a controversial $200 million advertising campaign she'd put public money into. What do we think the thing is that put Bondi over the edge for him?
I think it's a broad frustration with Bondi not doing the things he wants her to do in an affirmative sense. It's not that she stood up to him per se, but he seems to have an imagination of the Department of Justice as a force that goes out there and basically implements his will on everything from elections to civil rights to a host of other issues, including going after his political rivals and foes. And Bondi has certainly not been moderate in that regard. But this president has really, going back to his first term, and I think it's important that you note that some of the turbulence during his first term, he's had an extreme focus on the Department of Justice. And if you look back to his first term, you know, Jeff Sessions, who was the first attorney general and was one of his most loyal lieutenants, one of his closest allies, you know, going back into the 2016 campaign, when the establishment of the Republican Party was not with Trump, Sessions was. And they seemed to share a tremendous amount of ideology, politics, you know, at least in good measure, personal agreement. And yet, when Sessions basically said, look, there's a way to run this department that makes sense. It's going to be extremely right-wing. It's going to be, you know, very favorable to a lot of things you want. But, you know, there's some things I have to do to make it work. Trump blew up, right? And Sessions was gone. And if you look at the Department of Justice, there was repeated turnover there to the point where you had, you know, acting attorneys general all the time and a real lack of clarity about who was in charge at different points, you know, with Trump kind of raising up other figures within the department, even when an AG was there or an acting AG. So this is a long-term reality. And I think it may have less to do with Bondi per se than with just his sense that he never seems to get the satisfaction he wants out of the Department of Justice.
Talk about Todd Blanche, the person who's going to be sitting in Pam Bondi's seat, at least for the time being.
No, Blanche is clearly a Trump loyalist, somebody who's, you know, literally been, you know, Trump's ally and spokesman for quite a long time. And I assume that he will try very hard to do everything that Trump asks. I suspect he will be more aggressive than Bondi, though he's acting in this role. My sense is that he will not be a caretaker. He'll be very, you know, out front and trying to do Trump's bidding. That doesn't mean that he will become the AG, but it does mean that he could potentially. More significantly, it means that I think he'll set a tone and be probably quite aggressive in the sense that he'll be notable as AG, not just caretaking, but being out front at these press conferences, you know, at Trump's side. I suspect we'll see quite a bit of that.
So Nichols, I want to turn to news that broke right before we got on the air, which is about how much money the Trump administration is asking for in its military budget request. It says this is owing to the war in Iran. It is asking for $1.1 trillion in its regular budget request and another half trillion through a supplemental appropriation in a reconciliation bill. This would be, according to one analysis I just read, the largest increase in military spending as a share of GDP since the midst of the Korean War. It is a staggering sum of money that the administration has so far only proposed to offset with $78 billion in cuts to domestic programs. Political sentiment with the public was never very warm towards the war in Iran. It seems to be cooling on Capitol Hill. The Trump administration can't even maneuver the politics of getting the Department of Homeland Security funded. What do you think this request does to dynamics on the Hill?
Well, I think this request forces the hand of Democrats who've often been too deferent to Trump and Republicans who've been too loyal to him. And you are really talking here at a point when, you know, all the things that you've said are true. And also when there are reports that, you know, debts and deficits are skyrocketing. And, you know, this is something that Republicans once worried about. And so you have an incredibly unpopular war, one that is, you know, clearly it wasn't liked before it was launched. It wasn't liked when it was launched. And as it's played out, I think it has caused people to become even more uncomfortable with it. Juxtaposed against a massive request for additional funding. And though you correctly note that it's offset only by 78, you know, billion in cuts to domestic programs, does, you know, put into stark relief that dichotomy of our current moment, that we always have money for wars, even unpopular wars that seem to be doing a lot of damage to, you know, not just countries on the other side of the world, but actually from an economic standpoint to this country. You know, a president who's not really made an effective case for the war. So I do think you have a point where It is within reason that Democrats could unite on this. If they do, in a closely divided Congress, both the House and the Senate closely divided, that could cause a lot of trouble for this proposal. Additionally, I think that there will be at least some Republicans, it may be a very small number, who step up to say this is unreasonable. We ought to have a debate. We ought to have at least some discussion about this. And notably, Rand Paul has already stepped up and been quite critical. Thomas Massie in the House, those are the usual suspects, to be quite clear, on the Republican side. And yet, it is, you know, possible, and we've seen some evidence of this, that some more Republicans could align with them. We're simply slow this process down. And so I don't see this this massive request getting immediate reaction or immediate approval. And I also think it's significant that members of Congress are at this point back in their districts. And I would predict that the town meetings that they have, that to the extent that they do, and Republicans don't have many of these, but also, you know, interactions with people in their districts. I think what they're going to hear is, we don't think this war is a good idea. B, we don't think, you know, bankrupting the country to fund it is a good idea.
What about the handful of Democrats on Capitol Hill who've been bullish on going to war with Iran? People like Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania or Jared Goldman, the ex-Marine who serves in the House for Maine. Any signs that any indication that an astronomical budget request would be the issue that could cause them to dig in and fight?
No. I think that, at least not yet. In Goldman, it's possible you could see, you know, some rethink there. Fetterman, at least, unless I'm misreading, has been, you know, kind of over the top in his enthusiasm for the Trump administration on a lot of Middle East issues. And so I wouldn't necessarily look to him as the person who will ask the right questions. I think you'd look more over on the Republican side to people like Tom Tillis, who's already shown some willingness to break with the administration, to, you know, obviously,
and has announced his retirement, so doesn't have to fear consequences in the primary.
Yes, he has an easy out. But then also, I think Lisa Murkowski, perhaps Susan Collins, who's facing a very serious challenge for her reelection, especially from Graham Platner up in Maine, who's made opposition to this war really central to a lot of his messaging. So you might see something there. And then, you know, then you get into the other members who historically have shown some a discomfort with massive military budgets, with undeclared wars, et cetera. And they tended to fold and be softer in their approaches than in the past. But you know, look at somebody like a Mike Lee from Utah, who has some history of raising concerns and raising objections. Not saying Lee will do this, but obviously, as we look at that map of the Senate, that's where we look. I do think the more serious likelihood of a delay or of just some refusal to go along with this, to embrace it, is in the House as opposed to the Senate. But, you know, we'll look at both of them. The Senate's easier to look at because there's a handful of people who, you know, tend to be in play there. The House, you have always the question where the Freedom Caucus and some of these very right-wing, budget-conscious Republicans end up on this. And if many of them are very pro-Pentagon, so it's a challenge for them. It's one that doesn't easily come. It's a no that's harder for them to make. But I suspect there will be at least a few of them who are looking at this amount and literally saying, you know, this is too much at a time when we simply don't have clarity on what we're even trying to do.
I'm racking my brain for a time when Congress ever said no to a request for accelerated military funding. I'm not coming up with anything. There's this kind of facile political rhetoric where, you know, you send U.S. troops into harm's way without congressional authorization and then tell members of Congress they're against the troops if they don't appropriate the money for more weapons and armor for those soldiers. Are there meaningful moments where fiscal pushback in Congress restrained U.S. war abroad?
Some. I think, and whether they succeeded in actually cutting the funding is another issue, but if you look back to the Vietnam War era, what you started to see in the, you know, later stages of that war were strong bipartisan measures to try and cut the funding or reduce it. And it's the old Cooper Church bill and others, which I think did have an impact on the demands, on the requests from the Nixon administration. I think also that in the later stages, and it's a different context, but one you did see in the later stages of the U.S. war with Iraq and its play out, that Congress started to really ask tougher questions and be somewhat bolder in pushing back. And so I do think there are points where we can see in history that there's been at least a dialogue there, at least some assertion of Congress's role. But this would be unique in this moment, because this is very early in a war, and usually that's a point at which wars tend to be popular. This is different in this circumstance. This war is not popular, and so you do see some dynamic there. The other thing that I think distinguishes this is that whether you liked George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush and their wars in the Middle East, they at least tried to, on a pretty regular basis, communicate what they were trying to do to the American people and to allies around the world. And that, whether, again, I happen to disagree with them, but at least they made that effort. Trump has been so incoherent in communicating about this, as was evidenced by his speech, his 20 minutes on TV or whatever the other night, that I think you might see openings for some, pushback here. Although, I don't discount your question, Brian, because the history of this Congress, not the current Congress, but this Congress in the modern era, has been to be essentially a rubber stamp for Pentagon spending. And that's why we have, the largest Pentagon budget in history now proposed to go up at a dramatically faster and larger rate. When you put all the pieces together, Congress has not inspired confidence on this issue. And so it does fall to the American people, especially in this break period, to communicate where they're at, what they think is important. And I will say, I was at the No Kings event in St. Paul over the weekend, and I was struck by how resonant the anti-war messages were in many of the speeches that were delivered, including especially Senator Sanders' speech. They spoke a lot about this war. They spoke about opposing new funding for it. And those were messages that received sustained applause, even to the point of people at one point chanting, "End this war." And so there's something out there. There is a deep discomfort with this war. And I think that to the extent that that's communicated, that may have some influence on the process.
Which is really an organic phenomenon, because there were critiques before the demonstrations actually happened that anti-war messaging was not a prominent part of the call for the demonstrations. It wasn't coming from the national organizers. This was like participants in the protests, speakers on the stages, organically injecting that as an issue.
It was, in fact, quite notable. Although I will say that the organizers, I think, kind of picked up on it as you got toward the day and on the day itself. But it is quite notable that Bruce Springsteen, as an example, finished his brief set by raising his guitar above his head and saying, "No Kings, No War," and thunderous applause. Rob Weissman from Public Citizen led the crowd in chants of "No Kings, No Ice, No War." And they went on so loudly and for so long that he finally had to, kind of quell them so he could continue his speech. Same thing happened with Sanders and with a number of other people. That's just one example in one city, but from what I understand, it was something you saw in a lot of other places. And I think you're right, this is organic. There has not been a sufficient, organized anti-war response, except from some traditional anti-war groups like the Friends Committee on National Legislation, folks like that. This is a moment when I think that to the extent that people like Sanders and others step up, and frankly, when moderate Democrats step up, they will find that there is a tremendous amount of sympathy for an anti-war position.
All right. John Nichols, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
It's been a pleasure. We covered a bit of territory today.
Just a bit to cover out there.
That's Brian Edwards-Tiekert from a favorite show of mine called Upfront. It's available as a podcast. And John Nichols with the Nation magazine splits his time between D.C. and Madison, Wisconsin. The mention of Robert Weissman and Public Citizen, a group founded by Ralph Nader, by the way, reminds me that the Friday Forum featured a litigator from Public Citizen talking about a couple of case studies of what he's been busy with trying to get the courts to do things like turn around the AIDS cut at the international level, et cetera. So that'll be rebroadcast this coming Wednesday. Thanks again, everybody who made us burst the top of our thermometer here. It's a graphic image that I can see, you can't, but we matched the $10,000 that someone put up. But it shouldn't stop you from donating some more if you want to, or if you hadn't gotten around to it in this pretty short pledge period. I usually have to do two of them, and I called it pledge period again. It's a donation time, that's right. We want your money. We don't. Your goodwill's fine, but give us the cash, right? We need your support. A little excerpt, and I can't use my the computer I've had access to play Jeff Cohen. Again, he's co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy Reporting. If you've been listening well, you heard the excellent show Counterspin with Janine Jackson. Martin Lee and Jeff Cohen were original founders, along with Norman Solomon a little bit later. And he was interviewed last week about the possibility of what the energy from No Kings could do. I know this is a bit controversial in some regards, but as just recounted by John Nichols, the anti-war sentiment was everywhere. I don't trust the 8 million attendance figures either. People were telling me that they sort of counted up people who, you know, clicked on something to participate and didn't actually do the hard work of drone flights. And I don't even know how many people showed up here. So again, this is an excerpt and gets into some California stuff, but we won't be getting to that since I've got about 9 minutes left of the show. Radio Free Labor coming up. Thanks for supporting community media. Big game, FA Cup final. That's my spin on things. I guess we have a Balkan Five on the team. I didn't know they were recruiting from the Balkans, but five members are Balkan, and one of them is probably Bosnia and Herzegovina. And if they win tonight, he'll be as happy as he was when Bosnia and Herzegovina eliminated Italy from the World Cup. That's just, again, advocating my sport. Here's Philip Muldry and Jeff Cohen.
Trump got independent votes in 2016 over Hillary, as he seemed to be the anti-war candidate. And Hillary was seen as pro-war. And in counties and districts that had a lot of veterans of these forever wars, this is 2016, so the wars had started in 2001, 2003, the sentiment was to look for an anti-war candidate. And part of the rebellion today on the right wing against Trump with these influencers, whether it's Joe Rogan, who's got the huge podcast, Tucker Carlson's got the huge podcast, Dave Smith, the right wing libertarian, who's calling now for Trump's impeachment after having endorsed him in 2024. A lot of people, even in the America First grouping, thought they were getting an anti-war president, and they're appalled. And they're at the Conservative Political Action Committee conference that just happened this weekend in Texas. People were cheering at the word impeachment hearings for Trump. So, you know, when you see that it's across the spectrum, this is one of the most unpopular wars in history, and it's unpopular from day one. Usually it takes a while for U.S. wars of aggression to become unpopular. This is unpopular from day one, and you have the Democratic leadership in Washington not only unwilling to say they won't support money to this war, they have consistently stalled war powers resolutions. There should have been one in the House before the war even started, but the leadership of the Democratic Party stalled it. And we should have had a vote on Friday when the Democrats, this is Greg Meeks, is the head of House Foreign Affairs, and Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, they had the votes to pass a war powers resolution. How do we know that? Because the first time it was up, they only lost by four votes, and four Democrats went over and flipped and voted with the Republicans. Three of those four said they were now going to vote for a war powers resolution to stop the war in Iran. And Nancy Mace, a right-wing Republican who bolted from Trump on the Epstein files, she was denouncing the war. She was saying this war should stop. And then someone interviewed her on Friday and said, did the Democrats reach out for you after you made these comments? And she said no. So, the House and Senate are now, it looks like, on a 2-week recess. And we could have had a vote on Friday if we had better Democratic Party leadership in Washington. We could have had a positive war powers resolution vote. And now the war will go on for 2 weeks while members of Congress are out in their districts. That's why if people go to the homepage of rootsaction.org, you'll see we're organizing, you know, ask for meetings with your senators who are in their districts now, in your neighborhoods, or your member of the U.S. House, ask for meetings. If you can't get meetings, set up picket lines or protests. But we need to take this No Kings energy and focus it on replacing the Democratic leadership and getting the Democratic Party, it is the opposition party after all, to stand up to Trump and stand up to war when it's so popular to take that position across the political spectrum.
Well, we haven't even mentioned AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the funding they have done of candidates in the primaries, and the attempt to kick out any representative that voted against Israel. The AIPAC money is huge, and they've been throwing it around with great abandon, and Hakeem Jeffries and Senator Schumer both are very hesitant to cross AIPAC. In fact, they're in bed with AIPAC, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought it up. I mean, we've been trying to get at Roots Action, we've been trying to get the Democratic National Committee to come up with just an obvious statement that AIPAC brings in right-wing Republican money and defeats progressives in Democratic primaries. They defeated Jamal Bowman in New York with millions of dollars. They defeated the great Cori Bush in St. Louis with millions of dollars. Thankfully, she's trying to run again and regain that seat. And the Democratic National Committee won't take a position that we are against Republican money coming into Democratic primaries through AIPAC. And, you know, in New York, we have the Breakfast Club, where one of the hosts refers to Hakeem Jeffries as Hakeem AIPAC Shakur Jeffries. And, I mean, here's an example of Schumer. I live in New York most of the year, and Schumer is my senator. He never endorsed the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, the popular Zohran Mamdani. But here's what he said just less than 4 weeks before Trump and Israel started the war against Iran. He's meeting with, as it's reported, a breakfast gathering of Jewish leaders in New York. And he says, quote, this is Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats who should have been replaced a long time ago, quote, all the aid that Israel needs, I will continue to fight for it. And we delivered more security assistance to Israel, our ally, under my leadership than ever, ever before. We will keep doing that, unquote. And, you know, the other senator from New York, people don't know this because she's so ineffective, Kirsten Gillibrand, also an AIPAC ally, she's the head of the Democratic Senate campaign committee. And, you know, we would have defeated Trump in 2016 and 2024 if we had a better Democratic leadership. She's the one who were, is leading the Democrats to try to retake the Senate. And here's what she said in September. She was meeting with a bunch of Jewish leaders. And by the way, when I say Jewish leaders, I'm Jewish. And the Jewish leadership is almost as out of touch with the average Jewish American voter as the Democratic leadership is out of touch with the average Democratic voter. But there have been polls showing already in the fall that only 8% of Democrats supported Israel's war on Gaza. And 75% of Democrats, this is back in the fall, the numbers are even more extreme now, 75% of Democrats opposed more military aid to Israel. Gillibrand sits down, she's the head of the Senate campaign committee for the Democrats, and she tells a group, oh, 9 out of 10 Democrats are pro-Israel, quote unquote. How can you lead a party when you're so out of touch with what the average voter in your party believes? We saw this at the 2024 convention of the Democrats when they wouldn't even allow one Palestinian American to do a 3-minute speech. And the speech had been vetted by the Democratic Party leadership. When you see the attrition, the number of Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, young Americans, African Americans, even young Jewish Americans that had voted for Biden in 2020 and did not vote for Harris in 2024, a major factor, and the polls show this, is that she would not budge from the immoral position that the Biden administration had taken on Gaza while the genocide was going on, and they wouldn't even let someone speak. So, Philip, I'm so glad you brought up AIPAC. It supports racism at home as it supports racism in the right-wing regime in Israel. AIPAC does not represent most Jewish Americans. But if you talk to Schumer and Gillibrand, that's who they think Jewish Americans are. It's their AIPAC donors.
The public spokesperson for Trump, when asked about yesterday's No Kings, her name is Abigail Jackson. She characterized these events that drew over 8 million people in 3,300 events across the country and around the
world. Aldery interviewing Jeff Cohen. I wanted to get that line in some of the analysis of the Democrats' fecklessness, as it were. It's 11 o'clock. I guess I should play an underwriting announcement.